Welcome back from Flyout Week. Now's the time where you stop talking. How many people have heard this song before? Who wrote? Did anybody in the audience write the song first? No. Okay. How many people have heard this song? You've heard this song? You think so? We are listening to it right now live over the internet, courtesy of mp3.com. In fact, some of the music that you've heard over the course of the term has been courtesy of mp3.com. Of course, we could listen to it and then... Well, am I turning myself down, too? We may be stuck with the music from mp3.com. Let me just do it with some volume control. There we go. So that was courtesy of mp3.com, and there's at least one person in this room who brought mp3.com to us, and I was hoping we have four guests here today who together bring an amazing breadth of experience and market capitalization to this room, and I thought we'd have a chance to have a conversation among us, everybody here, and one that my guess is will be all the sessions we've had, perhaps the most practical of the sessions that you may experience in this course. You've just come back from Flyout Week. For many of you, you've been tromping around to different firms, wondering, what is it about Aiken, Gump, Debevoise, Slots, Plimpton, and Fromm that particularly interests you? And you have any questions about the firm. And so you've had a chance, whether you like it or not, to reflect on your future or non-future, depending on how you view it. And various options that may or may not be available to you. And I'm hoping that some of this class will be thinking about that, because at least a couple of the people here were once where you are, and it wasn't that long ago. So with that, why don't we start? Just Jordan, please introduce yourself. Please, if you could. Introduce yourself. Tell us the story of why you think you're here and how you got here from being here.
Actually, I know why I'm here because February of 97, or the winter of my third year, I was in Lawrence Lessig and Jonathan Vitrine's first cyber law class here at Harvard Law School. And I managed to keep touch with Jonathan through the internet as my life cycle progressed. And he sent me an email several months ago saying, why don't you come back and talk about what you've been through? Since you guys just came back from Flyout Week, Jonathan thought it might be interesting to talk about this from the perspective of someone who escaped from being a lawyer as quickly as humanly possible. I graduated in 97, moved to San Diego, got a job with a large international law firm called Baker McKenzie, was sent to New York City to work on mergers and acquisitions, working the mythical 130-hour work week for a period of 3 months, quit, and join an internet company. And
how did that happen? Turned out pretty well. How did you hook up with the company?
Well, actually, it turns out that between your class and the internet and business class, I had been working on a business model for an internet music company for about 6 months and had developed a large number of ideas about where things might move and where some of the strengths and weaknesses might be. And in my research, it turned out that a small company called Zico in San Diego had just started a newsletter about something called MP3, and since they were in San Diego, I decided I might call them when I was home for Christmas for 3 days, and it turns out that Michael and Josh had been coming from the ground up and developing a business plan for an internet music company that looked very similar to what I've been developing from the top down, and we sat down and started hashing that out, and it looked really good. I actually then did not start immediately. I started working with them on a consulting basis for about 2 months and became an official part of the company simultaneously with the VC money in December.
December of?
1998.
December of 98, the company was officially funded for its first round of venture capital money.
Right. The deal closed on New Year's Day, and the money was in the bank in the middle of January.
In the middle of January, 99.
Yes.
And we are now in November of 99, if my watch is accurate. The company is now public, is that right?
That's right.
What's the market cap of the company?
Actually, I think somebody else on the panel might be able to tell you better since it changes dramatically from day to day. but it's somewhere between 2.5 and 5 billion.
And in
the, oh yeah, you can look it up. Yeah,
go to town, please. There's a browser on there while we talk. How much of the time between January of 99 and now, or from the time you left the company, which was just recently, right?
Right. I retired last month.
You retired last month. How old are you again?
I turned 28 in October.
And 28 in October, okay. How much of that time was spent worrying about internet music business models versus starting a company, talking to VCs, doing presentations, doing things that weren't necessarily actually working on the company as a company?
That is actually a very good question, because what ended up happening, Michael and a gentleman named Robin Richards, who was the president of the company, essentially from the moment the VC money came in until a month after the IPO, so it's the time period that you're talking about, were 100% involved with the money part, that is, going, talking to VCs, negotiating that deal, closing that deal, immediately starting to talk to investment bankers about starting a ramp up for an IPO, doing the roadshow, talking to the financial communities, closing a few key strategic deals that enable us to do evaluation, validation, ramp up, going from 30 million to 50 million to 300 million to a billion before the IPO happened, and spending almost no time on operational side of the company or on the business model development side of the company. And that mantle fell to me and Josh, actually. So the company ended up dividing into a group that was focused almost entirely on ramping out a financial, so it would be public market side, and then a group that was focused internally on developing the actual company, which was happening in real time.
I'm reminded of the, I don't know if it was President Harding or Coolidge who said, the business of the American people is business. Kind of the business of any startup company is business to start with, rather than the widgets or the music or the actual.
That's very true, particularly in our space, because it moved so quickly. And even as the time of turnover for MP3 was so rapid, there were still two or three other IPOs that came out in a very similar time frame. And the capital that it gets you to go public, the cash obviously that gets you to go in public, and the first mover advantage is so large. It just became imperative that we move as quickly as possible to get that out the door. Even as we were changing our business model and talking about tools and development on a day-to-day basis.
And how important would you say lawyers were to the process? I mean, I suppose to the extent that it was about business and not about music, was the firm basically, at some point you retained a firm or outside counsel to handle documents and such?
I don't even know that much about that.
This is the compartmentalization within the company. Right. Michael worried about that.
We had Cooley Goddard was our corporate counsel, and Cooley Goddard had been the corporate counsel from the signing of the VC deal, and worked all the way through as our representative in the IPO negotiations with the investment banks, and handled most of that area. We actually had a few internal, had used to be lawyer types handling some of the issues that you might think a company would handle. And we finally actually managed to bring an in-house counsel in about a month before the IPO, which is desperately needed because, as you know, there are so many issues having to do with intellectual property and copyright that we should have had somebody handling, but didn't until that point.
Gotcha.
And Cooley was in no position to help us in that area, by the way.
Gotcha. If you can explain, what's the business model of the company, at least the current business model of the company?
What terms do you want me to use?
Understandable ones. I wouldn't presume. Presume I am very ignorant about how MP3 works.
Okay.
So here I am. I just want to understand. I'm considering whether to buy some stock in MP3.com.
The reason I ask is because there's at least two and probably several different ways of thinking about that. One direction is sort of coming from a revenue model. Another is coming from sort of a development model. What I'm going to talk about is the strategic vision of the story.
So what's a revenue model and what's a development model?
The revenue model is coming in and saying, okay, what are your actual revenue streams? What are your cash flows that you're focusing on if you're going to hinge your company into developing revenue and ramping that revenue up according to some projections? This is something that really becomes more problematic after you've gone public, when you've got to hit your numbers and you have to be able to articulate where that money's going to come from.
And the ultimate idea is that you make money and then the money gets I mean, the General Electric model is we make money, and then we eventually get together as a board, and we vote a dividend to the shareholders, right? And that's how you hold the stock, and you get part of the profit of the company. Is that the model you're working with here?
No.
How does it work?
Well, our business model is very different than that. Our business model has to do with the notion that we're talking about a space where we're trying to look 3, 5 to 8 years ahead and saying this is a very large and open market. And the current market that is holding that is the music market in general, which spans all the way from commercial music, i.e. the ASCAP and licensing fees, through the record labels and into various other aspects of what music does, music videos, MTV, radio, the whole span, really, how music can be turned into money, is something that is characterized by antiquated institutions that generally hate each other and a severe tension between the talent and the business side, i.e. it's a great place to get in there and start trying to figure out how to break apart the current structure, change that structure, and then put yourself in a situation to derive revenue from that. And our business model really involved a fundamental walking through and looking how the various power players operated and how the value chain worked and how these players negotiated, and then looking at that and saying, okay, how can we apply an internet efficiency to some of these negotiations? How can we find a way to cut out middlemen? How can we find a way to increase the ability of the people who are creating value to extract as much of that value as possible?
So on specifics, I mean, we had a panel here a few weeks ago in which, it was mostly hypothetical, but based on real-world facts, in which we had, the publisher takes 90% of what the artist produces, perhaps in literary context, maybe even more in the music context.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying if we can get rid of the publisher, I mean, that's what happens with MP3.com. You go and you can just pick music, right?
That's right.
I don't know, how many people have visited MP3.com? All right, so there's a lot of mind share out there about the...
That's better than the statistical average.
How many people have spent money on MP3.com? Huh. Congratulations, you're bolstering the company's $6 billion valuation. Yeah. But now the money... So far, what you said on the money side is we're not looking for short-term money. Somehow we're going to reinvent the music industry, and then out of it will come a means of making money. Or...
Yes. Although it has to be said that as a public company, we are committed to certain revenues, and in fact, we've actually put together strategic relationships that guarantee our ability to generate those revenues over a three-year life cycle.
So just to be specific, where does the money come from right now?
Right now, about 50% of the money comes from on-site advertising, and 50% of the money comes from off-site advertising. So it is an advertising model.
So if you can get people to visit the site for whatever reason, they're listening to music, they're clicking on things, they're writing things, they're reading things, as long as they're there and they're clicking, those are eyeballs that carry a value, and away you go.
Absolutely.
Does it matter? Are they basically undifferentiated eyeballs, or are they ones for which the more you can find out about the person clicking and watching, the higher a price it might fetch?
Oh, obviously the latter. The more you can sub-segment down both regionally and demographically, the better you can do in terms of bringing your CPM up. There's no doubt about that.
CPM?
That's the amount of money that you get per 1,000 impressions. Or, how to explain it, that's an advertising concept of how you pay for ad space. And actually, interestingly enough, I didn't even know this. It cuts across pretty much all advertising, CPM on television, CPM on billboards, whatever. And right now, a CPM on something like Yahoo is in the $1 to $2 range, which amounts to 0.1 cents per person per ad. So if I see a banner on Yahoo, Yahoo is getting 1/10 of a cent for that.
And how much of it is barter? Is it actually a swapping of banner ads? One site is swapping with the other. How much is actually somebody's bank account just transferred that 0.01 cent over to yours?
Well, for MP3.com specifically or across the internet in general?
If there's a difference.
There is a difference, actually, because MP3 started out having a large percentage of barter. Say 80% of our banner ads were barter. Because remember, you've got a web page template that has space that every time somebody pulls up the page, that space needs to be filled. If it's just blank, not only is it wasted, it also is ugly. You've got this weird thing where your advertising is part of your content. So there's a significant advantage in filling up that space, and you get this free marketing if you trade. So you trade with somebody who you think has a matching demographic, possibly somebody who has a good way of drawing traffic into your site, and you're putting banners on their site. As we've ramped up, though, one of the things we've managed to do is have a relatively low percentage of what's called unfulfilled inventory on our banner ads. So about 70% of our banner ads are bringing actual revenue in.
Gotcha. I see that you found the market cap. There it is. So it's at 49/116 today,
and it was about 65 about 3 days ago.
65.
Which tells you there's a lot of variability.
And what delta would that 3 days mean if you were still holding your MP3 stock, roughly?
I am still holding my MP3.
Oh, I thought you said you'd shuttered your doors and retired. And
No, I retired from the company, but I'm holding the stock. I actually cannot sell it until February.
Ah, so this is quite a typical thing. There are restrictions on, you join a company, right? You get a piece of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And then
when the investment bankers come in, part of the deal is that the insiders who have typically a large amount of the stock, including the VC actually, are locked in for a period of time, generally 6 months, sometimes 9 months. And somebody like Michael, who has a very large amount, will actually have a tier lock-in. And that lock-in means that, yes, the company has gone public, yes, you have stock, but no, you can't sell it on the public market until your lock-up period is out. So, for example, my lock-up period ends on February.
And is it simply a waiting period, or are there conditions such that if Michael were to quit the company, no matter how long he waits, he might not get to sell his stock?
I can't speak to Michael.
Generally, I guess I'm not particularly wanting to try.
It's a waiting period. It's actually in here to the stock itself, not to the person. It's on the certificate.
Okay.
So no matter what hour was due from now on out, I'd be able to sell the stock in February.
Gotcha. It's just a question of waiting as the stock.
Absolutely. And that's something to be taken into account. And that's a pretty large space of time that you have to, particularly for somebody. I mean, we went from being zero to public in 6 months, but then you have to wait another 6 months before you can do anything about it. And as a shareholder, you might also want to realize that once that six months is over, there's going to be a ramp up in the amount of liquidity, amount of stock that could theoretically be sold on the market, which is going to have an effect on the price if you intend to actually do so.
Here comes the chart just year to date. Looks like it opened at 90-something, went up on the first day as high as, looks like, 100.
It actually went up in the first minute to 105, and then rapidly went down.
Yeah, I see it was high now around 30 in late August,
yep.
And now it's fighting its way back up to 60.
And the guys from Raging Bull can actually tell you a little bit more about how that happens. It's a very interesting dynamic about how stock prices are determined based on the offer and bid, not about the average price that people might be willing to pay. So if a person buys 50 shares for $30, the price is $30, until somebody else comes and buys it at $60. And because MP3 went out with a very high liquidity, that is, we did a 3-2 split before the IPO, because our price had gone up too quickly when you're going around talking to all the investment bankers. Yeah, during the roadshow, we went from a $9 to a $28 pricing, which was a little bit too steep. So we did a split, which meant that we had a lot of stock out in the market, a lot of float, a lot of liquidity, and therefore a lot of volatility. It's now recently been purchased a lot more by institutional investors instead of the smaller investors, so that's going to slow down the volatility.
Gotcha.
By the way, I didn't know any of this until I started the company.
It rolls off the tongue really easily, though, doesn't it?
Great. It becomes a topic of serious conversation.
And I can imagine over the course of the day, millions of dollars of personal wealth could appear or disappear, depending on the vicissitudes of the...
Yes, I mean, the most... I'm not going to tell you what it affects me, but I can tell you what it does to Michael since he's not here. The difference between when I got on the plane yesterday and this morning amounts to about $20 million for Michael. And the difference between the day it opened and the bottom of the chart is about $300 million or more, maybe $1 billion. And that's a pretty big swing. And since you can't do anything about it for a long period of time, you have to kind of detach yourself from it. Fortunately, it all happens so quickly that you don't really make no effect. I mean, he still drives a Volvo and buys his clothes from Costco. It has no real impact. It's not real in any sense. Of course, Ted Waite, who's on the board and comes by quite frequently, drives a really neat Ferrari and has, you know, sharp clothes, but he actually sells the stock and has money.
But it's funny that the delta in price between the Ferrari and the Volvo still accounts for perhaps one trade in the delta of it.
Oh, yeah, very well. Now, I think that before we move on,
yeah,
one of the things that I should articulate is that, one, I did have a bit of a technical background, but not a very strong technical background before this. I have absolutely no background in the music industry whatsoever, and almost no financial background.
Is this how you open the roadshow?
It's in the warnings when it comes down.
The fine print.
The company know nothing about the business whatsoever. That's actually a good point. Michael knows nothing about any of those things either. He did not come to the music industry. He does not have a technical background. He does not have a financial background. Josh had a technical background. He had 1 year at Caltech before he quit. So these are things that can be done by any people in the room very quickly. If you go out there and it's about risk aversion, I think that if I had stayed at Baker McKenzie, things would have been slightly different, but I was willing to...
Were you operating equity in Baker McKenzie? You weren't.
No, actually.
No options.
No options, no stock, no share in the partnership income.
Definitely.
But I jumped ship and went out on a limb with somebody who looked like they had a lot of opportunity, but it wasn't anything guaranteed, at a third of the salary that I had at the time at Baker. And it turned out pretty well, but it could have very easily gone the opposite direction. So it's a really interesting risk aversion story. And it helps when you're still fairly young.
Right. Excellent. So we're going to come back to this, but it's a wonderful introduction to some of these things. And again, the business model that appears to be one of, so far, people come to the site, they use it, it's popular, you get traffic, you sell ads.
Yep.
Gotcha. I think, actually, since Bill has been working the machine so much, maybe you should go next, Bill. Tell us who you are and what you do.
I have a really interesting story. I'll even give you a disclaimer to the story before I tell it. When I first started telling the story, it used to take 15 or 20 minutes. And then our CEO and myself went out on one of those press tours, and we met all the bankers and everything else. And by the end of the tour, I was so tired of telling the story that it was about, oh, how you doing? We started a company. Here we are today. So give you a bit of my background. I'm 22. I am the founder of RagingBull.com, which is a financial website focusing on community based up in Andover. We're backed by CMGI and CNET. I started the company in late 97 after interning at Goldman Sachs for a summer. This was 97, and I was there that summer. I worked in PCS managing these, you know, really rich people's accounts. And more and more throughout the summer, I saw these guys who were like 24 coming in the door, probably like this guy over here, and opening accounts, you know, 30 or 40 million bucks. I'm just looking across the table at these guys. This is funny. And, that combined with the fact that I love the stock market, I love the internet, and all these different things came together, and I said, I've got to do something here. Went back to college. I was at the University of Virginia, and with a couple of buddies started the company, and started toying with it in our dorm room. The basic concept of the site was one of community. We have currently about 9,600 different message boards.
So let's see the mp3.com message board. Do you ever look at this, Jordan? Is this enough of a site that you... The Raging Bull particularly. How about that?
There's a guy short in this, baby. The message boards are just, if you think about a bulletin board in the offline world where you come along and post a message, I come along and read your message and respond to it, it's really just the electronic version of that, although we've overlapped it with some pretty cool features. We've wrapped around quotes. You can actually, if you find someone you like, I'll give you my homepage even. Anyway, to continue the story, in early 98, we were kind of in that, we were going to be sophomores, the three of us, and the typical thing for sophomores to do in college was, you know, go intern at Goldman Sachs or some investment bank, and here we are, we had this website, and we're like, do we really want to go back to Wall Street for another summer? And between the three of us, we decided that, you know, what the hell do we have to lose? So we threw about 30 grand together, and that May, this was May of 98, we out of my father's basement in New Jersey started Raging Bull for real. And we launched a product in June, which is pretty much what you see here today, although clearly a very early stage model of it, with different message boards so you can come in and talk about stocks. This is my personalized homepage. Every user on our site has one of these. As you can see, I track a lot of different stocks. Apple Computer, you know, we've got 23,000 messages on Apple Computer. We have thousands of messages basically on everything you want to talk about.
So you pull in, and there's 1,500 new messages about brain tech.
Brain tech's a new one.
How do you digest that? And I'm asking you as a user of the site as much as the guy that started it.
Well, that was one of the reasons we kind of excelled in this market. This stuff wasn't rocket science. The technology is really not that hard. I didn't have a technology background. But we overlapped it with some personalization features that allowed you to come in and get to your information quick and easy. Just to kind of give you an example, you know, Walker, this guy runs Chase Capital Partners in New York, $8 billion hedge fund. Doesn't post much, but he posted when we started the site. You can go, if you find someone you like on the site, you can track him and get to his content quick and easy. So it cuts out a lot of time going through 1,500 messages.
I see that this guy who runs the hedge fund, what, he said that Peapod makes no sense and heard that Amazon was about to merge with Borders. That was a year ago.
That was a year ago, so.
How's his phone doing?
Actually, he's doing well. There's Weatherall, who runs CNGI. He made a couple posts back in 98. So we have both the ability to track people who you like, and we also have, and this is just our huge marketing ploy, we have a feature called the Ignore button, which is kind of like one click of the button. If you don't like a person, boom, he's off the screen. You never see him again, which I don't know if any of you have spent time in online communities. You'll have these great discussions going on with hundreds of people, and one guy will come into the room and start spamming it. That fixes the problem.
People who have been on the names list over the course of the term, they were on a mailing list that included some guests, some of whom were spammy, if I may use that as an adjective.
So, continuing the story, we're working out of my dad's basement. There's three of us, three employees who we hired for the summer, and just working our asses off. I look back and it was just totally nuts. Just totally crazy the amount of hours we were working for. Really, at the time, I look back, what were we thinking? But by the end of the summer, we had befriended so many people on these boards. Every person who came to our site, we found out who they were. We became their best friends. And we built the site according to their liking, and that viral good word of mouth got going, and by the end of the summer, we were doing almost 200,000 page views a day.
And already at this time, is your revenue model one of eyeballs again? Getting a lot of people to the site for whatever reason, and then they see ads?
Yes, although that summer, we were, we're going to ramp up revenues, and, you know, if you look at his model with CPMs, if I'm doing 180,000 pages a day, wow, we should be making a couple grand a day. Not true, and we realized that real quick. You need brand, you need huge size, and you need relationships before you can ramp up revenue. So early on, we just said, screw it, it's not worth our time, let's just try to get big. So right now, that's our model, though.
So how many patients see them a day?
Well, back in late 98, we were doing 180,000. We got funded by CMGI. It was kind of an interesting couple of weeks. I was supposed to go back to school, and we had Lycos and InfoSeek over the phone call us up and offer us a couple million for the site. I said, we have something here. CMGI had found us. Dave Weatherall was surfing the internet on vacation and found us on the internet and invited us to come up. And I said, wow. You know, we put together a business plan overnight. 3 days later, I'm up in his office, spent the night at his house, just kind of eating pizza, and we banged out a deal that night where they put $2 million in for 40% of the company, and we all dropped out of school. Yeah, pretty good stuff. And since then, it's kind of give you the idea of how we've grown, because we've spent a grand total of about $70,000 in marketing since we started. January 1st of this year, we were doing 200,000 page views a day. Yesterday we did about $6.5 million off the $70,000 marketing.
And just by way of comparison, how does that rack up for a day at MP3? $6.5 million. Considerably more. Wow. Okay.
Kind of give you a comparison in our space. I don't know how many of you have heard of us. we haven't spent as much money as TheStreet.com or MarketWatch, so you don't see us on CNBC. We haven't built up that brand, but we have hardcore net users. But last month we did 120 million page views with about 2 million unique visitors. TheStreet.com did 15 million page views with about 1 million uniques. Motley Fool is 45 million page views with about 1.5 million uniques. So we've gotten big, pretty big quick. We raised another round of funding this past summer from CMGI and CNET. We raised $20 million at a $90 valuation. And we've just been hiring away. We've got about 55 people now. We hired a CEO in January. So.
And what's the future of the company? What might we expect to look different with $40 million and 6 months later?
$20 million we raised.
Yeah, we have other rounds, don't you? You know?
I don't know. We're kind of, it's actually interesting. I was talking to these guys about it, and particularly Direct Hit and what they're going to be when they grow up. And that's kind of like at the stage where we are right now. We've gotten big. We've gotten big quick. We're going to spend some money marketing. We're ramping up our revenues at a pretty incredible rate. Mediametrics had us as the seventh most stickiest site on the internet, the whole entire internet, in July. In front of us was three porn sites, and eBay, and like Yahoo Chat. So it's mind-boggling.
It's just a composite business that has yet to be explored.
That was plan B of the business.
Yeah.
Raging Bull after hours.
Raging Bull after hours.
So I mean, if you look at it, you know, someone like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal has 1.5 million people reading a paper every day. We're up to about 400,000 visitors on a daily basis who come. They spend 25 to 30 minutes on our site each time they visit the site.
So when you say sticky, by the way, that's another term that probably you didn't know before you started, and now it's second nature. What's sticky mean?
Sticky like flypaper. Someone comes, they stay there. And that is what everyone's trying to get on the internet.
Does it matter if it's the same person returning day after day, or it's just as long as you're there, you should stay for a while, and maybe you'll come back again?
There's a lot of different ways to look at the statistic. Ideally, the more unique people who spend the most amount, more amount of time, the better. Yeah. We actually, early on, we catered to the day trading audience and hardcore users because the challenge of starting a community site when you have no content, for example, you come to the Dell board and there's no posts, so what are you going to read? So what's the reason to post? So we catered to highly volatile stocks, highly active traders, and we got going. But we actually just ran surveys recently, and that it's a very, very small percentage. It's really grown, and it's just people talking about everything now.
And exactly the disadvantage you had before is now your advantage.
Exactly. We're sitting in a perfect position for online brokers, for American Express Financial Advisors, for Lexus. You know, we're kind of almost like a luxury portal. So talk about revenue streams, and that's probably your next question. The simple revenue stream in the near term is to monetize those eyeballs via advertising and sponsorships, which means we just signed $1 million deal with Discover, $1 million deal with Fidelity, $1 million deal with National Discount Brokers. So that, I mean, we have a perfect demographic. That's a simple one. We're also licensing our community out to other sites. If you go to AltaVista, we're their community. If you go to Thompson Invest, we're their community. We'll soon be the community for Forbes.com and a bunch of other sites.
So by saying you're their community, it's not just the software. It means that if you're in AltaVista and it says, come to the AltaVista trading board, it's actually Raging
right.
Bull underneath. And is it a separate crew of people, or they actually see what the Raging Bull numbers are posting?
They get to interact with our user base.
Right.
And, again, the toughest thing about a community is a critical mass. If you don't have a critical mass, it's impossible to get started. And that's our barrier entry. If you go to Lycos, you go to Quick, and you go to these huge sites with huge traffic, they just don't have any activity. So we're like licensing that out, giving them instant community. So.
Must have been eBay strategy to on auctions, thinking that no one should take that. And maybe that's still true. Jordan, did you have something you wanted to add? I thought you lost it.
Another mic here, too. I just want to say the two key dimensions that we try to track on stickiness are how sticky it is vis-a-vis a single user coming back multiple times, and having somebody get addicted to the site over time, and the other concept of stickiness is how long they actually spend within the site every time they come.
Gotcha.
And if it can be a separate matrix, it might be a benefit to have somebody be addicted to it and come back continuously, and it might also be a benefit to have somebody come and stay a long time whenever they come.
and you got different crossover points on how you want to use those different axes.
Gotcha. Now, Bill, part of your plan, a site in which you don't even provide the content, right? You provide the dance hall, and then people come in bringing their own musical instruments and play music for each other, and in doing so see blimps with ads overhead. I don't know if you've ever spoken this way to your investors. I'm not sure you should. But did you ever have a detour into worries about legal liability, saying, wait a minute, the one case that may be out there about blame being cast for harmful or damaging speech was a case in which somebody went out, talked down a company, and then the company says, great, you talked down a company, you talked down our stock. You got somebody like Jordan watching your board, sees the post go up at T equals zero, at T equals one, he sees his stock plunge, and he says, you know, it's a falsehood. They just said that, you know, some terrible thing had happened, which in fact hadn't happened. I mean, the companies come to you and say, you've got to clean up the board, there are lies about us, and we're going to sue you if you don't.
We actually have this neat thing at the office. We keep track of subpoenas. And some of the different founders and our CEO and different members of the management team have gotten subpoenaed at times for information about our users from the SEC. So I have like 9 since I started, so I'm just barely out of first place.
It could be. So this is a possible business model, too, the one-click subpoena model. Quick ascent. Okay.
It is a challenging area, which everyone's still trying to figure out. We technically, as our lawyers tell us, and we have lots of lawyers, so are your friends, is that we're not legally responsible for what's being posted there. We're really just the dance hall. And we don't take any steps to moderate that. We try to give that to the user. So really when companies come to us and they subpoena us, they want information about the user who posted that data.
And do you free up that information if you have it?
That's a very controversial subject. If you actually saw the industry standard today, that issue, someone's suing Yahoo for exactly that. We try, it depends, it's instance to instance. We try to stand by our users for however long as possible, but if the SEC is breathing down our neck.
Do you notify the user that somebody was subpoenaing if they want to fight it?
We attempt to, yeah. Again, that's not always easy to do since a lot of these people you can't track down.
But perhaps like Yahoo, you don't necessarily ask for a whole lot of information, certainly not verifiable information, before they can participate in the community anyway, right?
We do, actually. We get an email address. Actually, it's funny. I mean, we get a lot of data about users. People think when they're on the Internet it's anonymous. It's not. It's very easy to track your IP address, you know, what porn sites you've been to, et cetera. It's a dirty little trail.
You can sort of start a blackmailing business as part of the whole package. Great.
It's really actually the fun stuff. We get a lot of CEOs on the boards, a lot of insiders, and that's also Wall Street traders. Again, these are all our dirty little secrets, but I get calls from people on Wall Street all the time. You can hear the trading desk in the background, and they're like, you got to take this post down, you know. We just filed our RS-1 or something. And, you know, our lawyers are bringing it down our deck. So we're pioneers. We're blazing a trail here.
Have you ever taken down a post?
Mm-hmm.
So what drives you to do that? It's just
It is within our terms of service. We do, on a daily basis, we're getting over 30,000 different messages posted. And some of that's going to be spam. Some of that's going to be inappropriate. So the first level of defense is our users, just ignore them, et cetera. But we also have 6 people who are trawling the boards all day long. Their primary job responsibility is actually pull the content out of it. Again, one of the differences between us and thestreet.com is that it's all about our members and what they're posting. So if you come to her on the boards on the main page, this is what regular retail investors are saying about stocks. So we're kind of pulling that out of the community. At the same time, we do delete on occasion, which our terms of service permits. That's another revenue model for us as well, is taking all that sediment and pushing that out to institutions, out to IR people. So.
Now, it's interesting here, I'm just looking, Dr. Bob, is that a user or that's somebody that's one of your columnists?
We also have, about 40 freelancers we've hired, although Dr. Bob is, we hired him off the boards.
And he's writing about CMGI, which is one of your investors.
A little conflict of interest there, I guess. So.
And Dave wanted us to hype up the stock. This guy actually came right off the board. We hired him, and he's a great writer. And this is really the difference between us and a lot of our competitors, is that these people are producing editorial for us, but they also have a board where you can go and you can read about CNJ or CNET and then post your own thoughts and actually converse with them.
Now, to the extent that you and Jordan so far are describing models that are these advertising and eyeball models, have you sensed any trajectory about the appeal of that particular model over time to VCs? So if somebody comes in fresh to a VC tomorrow with an idea just like this one, but in a different market, not about investing, but about, I don't know, furniture, about whatever, is this likely to get as good a reception today, or is somehow the barn door closed on this model, at least in the starting days?
I mean, if you put together the right management team, any door is open for you, but the consumer market is rapidly closing. I mean, there are big brands being built in these areas, and they're going from the advertising model to, all right, where else are we going to get revenue streams? Like, we're trying to sit and capture actually a piece of the transaction when you do something, when you buy a stock with your broker. Multiple revenue streams is kind of the key word now. So it's becoming more and more difficult. Actually, to talk about CMGI a little bit, we're kind of right in their sweet spot. Dave Weatherall is huge into internet advertising, direct marketing, and taking data about users and targeting it. So a community site like ours is right up his alley.
So I want to make sure we have time to completely open it up. Gary, why don't you take the floor? I'd love to see your slides, too. Go for it.
I don't know if they've been pulled up yet.
They're there in a PowerPoint window. So you Alt-Tab over. But just tell us who you are and how.
Sure. Gary Cullis, graduated from HLS in 98. And started a company called Direct Hit.
That's it? Yeah, this is Windows 2000, so I don't know exactly how to start the stupid thing.
I think if you click on it before, down here at the lower left.
Yeah, I know this was one of these things.
To the right.
Or two more.
Slideshow.
Okay. Just got a little slide presentation here that I'll run through. Direct Hit, let me jump into the next slide here. Okay, Direct Hit today, we're a search engine company, and what we do, our business model is to provide search results to other portals and destination sites on the internet. What we do different than the other search engine companies out there is we're actually ranking the results by user popularity. So instead of just matching the keywords in the search request to the keywords in the document, we're looking to see what the millions of previous users on the internet have actually selected for similar search topics, provides a higher degree of relevancy in the results.
Do you have a canonical search you do to show how Direct Hit works better as a result?
We can try something.
So why don't you Alt-Tab over to the IE window and let's see. I don't know, how many people use Direct Hit to search? Couple. As Chris is there, he's the one who heard the music too. How many people use, say, Yahoo to search? All right, so let's see how Yahoo stacks up. What's something that would make sense to search for in which Direct Hit can show its stuff?
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, I think
we're
request from the audience.
Request from the audience.
Now remember, it has to be something that you think other people would have searched for. So somebody's name, for example.
So how about something like legal liability, stocks, and day trading?
Increasingly unlikely that you can do bad work.
How about legal liability and stocks?
Let me spell it right. So
this actually is not a candidate search query that other people have reviewed before. So the way you can tell when actually you do a search request, you'll get these little orange men that show up next to the...
An orange man means somebody
other
was there before you.
It, and they've ranked it by...
So let's do another one. Clearly, I'm just unto myself. Oh, yeah. Somebody up there? Go ahead.
We're on the search for free MP3 files.
Free MP3 files. You think anybody's ever searched for that? Let's see.
So here, obviously, a very popular search topic that other people are researching. And you can see it's ranked here by popularity. There's a lot of sites like GeoCities.
And the popularity means people searched for it once before and ultimately clicked upon it in the list. Is that right?
We're looking at how often the site is visited and how much time do people spend there. And time is a very important metric because a search description can be misleading. If somebody clicks through to a site, they spend 5 seconds there, we know that they didn't like it. If they spend 3 or 4 minutes, we have a stronger indication of its relevance. Actually, no. I was just asked if you can rig the search, pick out your site and click on it, spend time there and try and get it to the top. We actually spend a lot of time developing algorithms that look for that sort of behavior and screen it out.
And is the data gathered from people who use DirectHit.com to search, or is it come from other sites as well?
Well, good question. Our business model is to sell the results to other search engines and portals, and in return we get a data feed from them as to what their users are actually clicking on. So we have a network across about 20 portal partners right now where they're feeding us data as to what their users are doing. And while some people haven't been to DirectHit directly, you've probably used it before because we are the default results over at Lycos when you search for web pages over there. We also provide the default results at Hotbot, so your first 10 results are going to come from the DirectHit popularity engine. MSN is another portal partner of ours. LookSmart offers our results as an alternative to their traditional directory. So all these people, all these different sites are actually feeding us data as to what the users are clicking on.
And in this case, do you distinguish among users, or any user is as good as any other as far as building the database?
Our standard product right now counts all users equally. We do have another product called Personalized Search that's not in operation yet. We're working with various partners to implement it. The way it works is we actually take account of the searcher's age, gender, and geographic region. So if a woman is searching for shoes, for example, we're going to show her sites that other women have selected. So you get better resolution in the search results targeted to the demographic of the searcher.
It ultimately converges to bookmarks, which is here's what you searched for before, but
in some ways,
people like you who...
It's different than bookmarks. Bookmarks are a one-to-one.
Right.
It's what you've been through before. Here, we're really leveraging what other people have done, so there's a collaborative filtering element to it as well.
Gotcha. And if we were to do free MP3 on a non-direct hit powered site, one might expect that the results wouldn't be ordered as well because they're not using this filter to do it.
That's right. The other technologies, again, just match the words and the request to the words in the document. The other way of doing it is to have a staff of editors, which is what Yahoo and LookSmart do. So they add a lot of manpower. The editor model is an attempt to get human intelligence into the ranking algorithm by admitting a site to the sort of Yahoo or the LookSmart universe. They actually pay, you know, a staff of 200 editors to do that. We are leveraging the millions of people that are out there every day searching the internet to do it essentially for free. It's much more granular, much more responsive. We've got nearly 100 million sites in our directory, and Yahoo has approximately a million. So it's orders of magnitude greater in terms of the resolution it can provide.
And you make money for every search that's done because, in this instance, you're making money because we're looking at Mariah.
Exactly.
And she's paying money to be seen by us.
That's right.
In a case in which it's through Lycos, Lycos is paying you money, which in turn is a portion of the money that Lycos is getting to show people Mariah.
Exactly. So our business model, one is based on direct advertising revenues, the other one is based on a CPM charge, same metric, cost per 1,000, of selling the search results directly to end sites, destination sites, that then put an advertising banner on the page and show the user.
And what got you into this idea?
Well, my background actually, I joined the patent bar in 1993 and was writing and prosecuting patent applications as a non-attorney, so as a patent agent. And I used to do a lot of patent research and found that by talking to other researchers I could perform better searches. Say, you know, have you seen this before? Where was it? What query did you use? How did you get there? So fast forward to law school, discovering the internet in approximately 1995, realized that there was a big paradigm shift that had happened for information retrieval. Traditionally, there had been one or two users and millions of documents, and so it didn't make sense because you wouldn't really have the overlap between the users. They weren't necessarily looking for the same thing. But with the internet, that paradigm shifted to millions of internet searchers as well, and there's a high likelihood that people were looking for the same thing. And in fact, that's true on a monthly basis. 85% of search requests are looking for the same thing. They're actually syntactically identical in their format.
And what do they tend to be about?
You can imagine what some of the more popular queries are. But MP3 actually is one of the more popular queries. So it's all over the map.
Huh. Great. So I interrupted your presentation. Sorry.
No problem.
I think it's actually the beige framed picture of a pie chart.
Yeah, right there.
I guess you want to, yeah, resume the slideshow.
So, just continuing along the line of thought, what did I do then after that is once I realized that there was this resource out there that traditional search engines weren't taking advantage of, started doing a lot of research to find out if they were, in fact, planning on developing something like this, did patent research to find out if there was any patents pending in this area or any issued patents, and in fact found nothing. So I started sort of architecting the system on a high level, designing the flow of information, capturing these through redirects what the users are actually visiting, reincorporating that back into the ranking algorithm, and ended up filing some patents on it. So just to complete this slide, this just talks about where we are today. We've raised about $30 million in three rounds of financing, 60 employees and over 20 partners. So coming back now to the topic, how we got started, designed the engine, filed the patents, and realized that I needed to recruit a developer and actually go ahead and code up a prototype. So I basically emailed some MIT computer science students, found a guy over there who was highly interested in what I was doing. So together, he and I worked on the prototype. He did most of the coding in one of the more recent languages. My coding skills were sort of antiquated. I hadn't programmed since Fortran. So he ended up developing the prototype. Together, we entered the MIT 50K competition, which is a business plan competition. And this would have been around February of 1998. And I recognized that I needed a CEO soon, somebody who had sort of built and run a successful company before. And was fortunate enough during the 50K, they have a lot of networking events to actually meet somebody who fit the bill perfectly. So I recruited a 35-year-old CEO who had built and sold his company to Artisoft and was basically in retirement and looking for his next gig. So brought him on board, gave him a percentage of the equity, and together he and I co-founded the company in April of 98. So this slide talks a little bit about the first round process. It's the hardest part, obviously, raising the first round. The way we started is we started in March of 98, speaking informally with some local VCs. We didn't have a business plan at this point. And it was a good thing because by not having a business plan, we kind of preserved our right to come back to them with a formal business plan when everything was in order. So we were still recruiting the team. We needed to refine the business model. We weren't quite sure, would portals buy this? Would it be seen as competitive? Or how would it interface with their existing search engines? How do they deal with their legacy systems? All these issues come up. So we needed to come up with a firm business model. In April, we basically finalized that by talking to a bunch of people and came up with a business model that was technically and financially risk-free to the portals. And the way it worked is that we decided that we would offer our services as an alternative to their existing search engine. So on top of the existing results, there'd be a small link that says click here to see the results ranked by popularity. Nobody clicks on it, then they didn't have to pay us anything. So we would only get paid for click-throughs. Put an ad banner on the page, split the revenue 50-50, that was financially risk-free. Technically, if our systems went down, they just removed the link. So that was a critical step, actually, in getting the search engines to say yes. You make it very easy for them to say yes. We still needed customers. So we basically arranged a West Coast trip where we went out in April of 98, flew out and met with all the major search engines, Excite, InfoSeek, Lycos, which we met with here locally, AltaVista. Most of them are on the West Coast, even our good friends Inc2Me. And so we met with all of them, and we got significant interest. It was clear that none of them were working on a similar technology or even really thought of this paradigm shift. They were all designed basically in the old paradigm and, in fact, had created the new paradigm. While we were out there talking with the customers, we ended up getting a meeting with Draper Fisher Jurvetson. It's a pretty well-known venture capital firm. They funded Hotmail, 411, some other companies, Parametric Technologies, Upside Magazine. They're really deep into the Internet space. And the meeting was very interesting because, we were able to get all the partners there at 8:30 in the morning. The earlier the meeting, the more likely that they're all going to make it. And we gave them a 45-minute presentation and told them that at this point we had interest from two search engines. So we really had the last element that we needed because what I left off the previous slide was the fact that we'd recruited some developers who had agreed to join the company. We had an experienced CEO. We had patents pending. We really just needed money. The company was in a state ready to go, just add money. So we made our pitch to them. They got excited. They had been funding other search companies like GoTo.com, a sister company of ours. And Tim Draper yelled out during the meeting, we should take $1 million for a third. So we figured that we actually had an offer there. We thanked them, came back to Boston, thought about it for a little while, countered with five, settled on four, and actually raised the money. In just about 2 weeks to do all the legal work. We wanted to move quickly.
Did you have a lawyer at the meeting?
No, we didn't. We didn't even have a law firm at that point.
And is that, would you say, typical? Lawyers don't actually go into the meeting with the VCs because they just kind of rain on the parade?
Yeah, lawyers don't go into the VC meetings. Maybe they do with other companies. They didn't with us. The thought never crossed our mind, actually. These negotiations are very rough. There's really no need to have sort of any resolution on the details at that point. So, you know, as I mentioned, the numbers are just sort of being thrown out in the air, and there's not much basis behind them. It's kind of interesting. Turns out we found out later that, you know, the average size of a deal like this is from $3 to $6 million. So we got in at $4 million. We thought it was great. It was the fastest money they've ever raised. I mean, we made our pitch at 8:30 in the morning. By 4:30, we had a term sheet. So that's really fast. Usually you can spend, you know, 2 or 3 months. So we were able to hit the ground running. It was really, really fast. We came back from that in, you know, late April and actually continued through the 50K, and the finals for that were May 7th. And fortunately ended up winning the competition. They had never had another company. Akamai was another entrant in the competition.
He's from Akamai.
And they're doing very well. It's a great company. So we ended up winning that competition.
For a loser.
So we felt very fortunate to have won, and we actually donated our prize back to the other companies, because in the spirit of the competition, the whole reason that they're giving the prize money is $30,000 in cash is to sustain the companies until they can raise money, and we felt like, well, we already had the offer in hand, and we should give the money to the other companies so that they can go out and raise money as well. Since then, we've actually raised two more rounds of financing. We did a $2 million second round in November of '98. We'd only burned through about half of our money at that point, so we still had, you know, $700,000 in the bank. And that's an ideal time to go raise money when you don't need it, because if you need it, then you're desperate, and people sense that, and you'll never raise the money. So that carried us through basically, I don't know, March of this year, and then we started thinking, how are we going to grow from here? It became clear that some other companies were on a massive growth spurt. AskJeeves and GoTo had just gone public, and before that had raised significant rounds. So that was actually good for us, because other people were doing it, so why couldn't Direct hit? So we went out and raised $26.3 million in July. And since then, we've released a slew of new products. We have a shopping engine, which is a preview version right now. We're ranking the products by popularity. Turns out popularity ranking in that context is a very powerful feature, because it ends up reflecting things like the quality of the merchant as well as the price of the product.
And just the intangibles of, why do I want a Cabbage Patch doll? Because everyone else wants a Cabbage Patch.
True. There is a users feel like they're getting recommendations from other users when they see a popularity ranked product. So it's pretty powerful. We just launched the directory engine with AT&T. And some other products that are in the works include corporate search. A lot of companies are coming to us and saying, hey, we have terrible search engines at our site, you know, 30,000 pages, can you help us? And we're working with them. And then Yellow Pages, I think, is a classic example. We haven't gone into that space yet, but it's a very big growth area because of cell phones. You can, you know, access Yellow Pages over the phones. And we're also looking at a public financing probably in Q1 of 2000. So just a few notes on the process. I like to throw in these points that sort of all seem to bubble to the top as we were going through our three rounds. I think advisors are important. I didn't mention it earlier, but we brought in Eileen Lang. She's the former CEO of AltaVista. This lent tremendous credibility to the whole project because, you know, we were able to navigate the waters much better, finding out things like CPM rates that we didn't know early on. I, you know, realize now that the source of money is extremely important. You know, we initially had heard that but weren't quite sure why, but after getting from Draper Fisher, it became instantly clear. All the partners felt like, hey, this is a credible company. They felt more comfortable doing business with us. And the press really picked up on it as well. So I think we got some good press out of that. Moving quickly is important. I think it's much more important to sort of get the company rolling instead of stretching the process out. Better leave a little money on the table so you just hit the ground running. It's all about speed in this space, and a couple of months makes a lot of difference. Somebody else came out with a similar technology in those 2 months. I mean, we wouldn't have gotten funded. So.
And do you actually think your patents would have been any relevant protection against a similar technology coming out?
That's a good question. And at the time, no, because, I mean, they were pending, and they're just now going to issue. We paid the issue fee on two of them, so they're going to be coming out soon. We'll actually get a patent number here in the next 6 weeks or so. But it's the wrong thing to try and rely, even if they'd issued, it would have been the wrong thing to try and rely on those, because getting tied up in litigation and spending the money and defocusing the management team from running the business, it's just the wrong thing to do at that stage. It's hard to explain why, but you just want to go out, it's a land grab, you want to try and get as much space as possible.
And how much of your time then was spent
the way Jordan describes, MP3 had to have this kind of left brain and right brain, one side just worried about the money and the other side working on the idea. Do you have a similar structure in your...
No, the two of us, Mike Cassidy and I, as co-founders, really did everything together in terms of raising the money. Roadshows typically reserved for public financings, but private financings, you're doing a very similar thing. You're setting up meetings and going on somewhat of a roadshow. So I went on all of those and then just tried to juggle, the other responsibilities, furthering the technology, prosecuting the patents, things like that. We were very fortunate. Our first financing literally took, a day of roadshow. Second financing took a couple of days. We ended up pitching at Red Herring Central Market East, and a bunch of VCs came up, and we just selected one and went with it. So that was very, very short. The third round took a little bit longer. It was about 3 weeks of distraction. But we were able, it was the summer, the internet kind of slows down, so we were able to take the time.
And what's the most you think you can raise privately? The biggest amount of money you might be able to get without having to go public?
Well, I've seen rounds, $100 million.
And MP3.com went public and raised how much?
The public.
$300 million. And of course, that was after you raised the IPO price. $10 million privately. I mean, I wonder, given that there's so much money everywhere from your vantage point, how do you decide whether public or private is the source of it? I mean, what's the added dimension that you get from going public?
I think it very much depends on the stage of the company. When we raised the third round, we had 30 people. To be a public company, you need a tremendous amount of infrastructure within the company. You're talking about like 10 people in finance.
You got to start filling out forms and dealing with the government.
You really got to make sure your distribution channel is built out so that you can sustain yourself. There's just a lot of growth that the company has to go through. So most companies when they go public. And Jordan, I don't know how big MP3 was, but 60, 80, 100 people generally when they go public?
It was a moving target.
It was
150 today when public.
Yeah. So generally you got to scale up to around 80 to 100 people. We're at 60 right now. So when we raised the third round, we were at 30. So after we go public at that point.
And I saw that in our readings, at least one estimate, that the New England job market was particularly sour. In fact, the New England region was about to go down the tubes, if you hear what, what's his name, David?
David Weatherall?
No. Come on. Who did the readings? David, what's his name? Yes, I heard it. David Birch, yes. He says New England is on the way out, that you're just recruiting people as fast as you can and putting them in.
The best way to hire is to hire the top positions first, and then they typically, assuming they don't have a no-poaching contract, will recruit their friends from the previous job or other previous companies.
So once people leave MP3 and come over here,
you kind of fill out from there. So.
Gotcha.
You made some key hires lately.
Okay. I'm mindful of the time. I'm sorry to keep distracting you from the slides. Go ahead.
Oh, well, we're almost through, actually. I just wanted to say it's risky to explore all options. In corporate law, we talked about conducting the auction, getting the highest value for the company. It's very tempting to do that. But if you do, every other VC that you bring into the game becomes one more person that can bow out. And as soon as somebody bows out, and thankfully we haven't had this happen, everybody gets cold feet. People start wanting to know who else is investing, who else is in. So you increase that risk dramatically when you start bringing in more people and trying to drive the price up. And I think another thing that's important to a company is having a leverageable technology or brand. Because if you get a brand established by word of mouth, such as Hotmail was done or Raging Bull was done, you've got an asset that you can leverage. If you don't have that brand, you're gonna have to buy it typically with $15 million in marketing. So when you're talking about starting an early stage company with $2 or $3 million, you just can't afford to buy that kind of mind share. So you better have a leverageable technology instead.
Gotcha. Okay, our last guest before we open it up a bit. Bob?
What would you like for me to say, how I got to this, or what about Akamai?
Well, in some ways, you're the one guy who's not like the others, not just because you're long in the tooth.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. But also because you're actually a lawyer.
That's true, I am, and I was. I had the luxury of being able to practice law for approximately 10 years before the internet really gained any popularity. That's a luxury nobody in this room or nobody at this table can enjoy. So I went a more traditional route, if you will, of being a securities lawyer for 2.5 years, getting sick of that, becoming an M&A lawyer for 5 years, getting a little sick of that, finding an interest in the technology, which in 1988, most lawyers did not like anything related to computers or technology, so it was a nice area to go into, which sort of evolved into the early stages of an internet practice around 95 or so. Where are we now? Oh, gosh, okay.
You're watching your stock price.
No, no, he's watching my stock price. I don't look. So that led me to practicing law at a law firm really in the early stages, I guess, of an e-commerce or an internet practice, which started out as web hosting and web development, graduated for me quickly into, I don't know if you discussed this in here, sort of the digital certificates and encryption practice.
That's normally what you talk about in conversation.
Yeah, that's exactly. And then evolving into working with various and sundry e-commerce clients, either, I kind of split things up two ways. You've got dot-coms, if you will, what I would put in MP3 and a Raging Bull in, and then the infrastructure side, where I would put DirectHit and where I would put Akamai. So I had some of both.
And are there any other categories, or that's pretty much it?
Well, you can slice and dice it however you want. I just keep it real simple. I'm sure everybody at this table would have a different way to slice it, but I guess you could slice a .com into a company that came into being like an MP3, straight as an internet company from the get-go, and then somebody like a UPS that was a brick-and-mortar company that is now evolving or has an element about them that is internet-based. And you could name any company out there in the world that has done that. So that would be another way to slice and dice it, if you will. So that's what led me into that space and representing companies in this arena. And then I started doing work for Akamai. You talk about getting enough people to go public. That can take weeks. It can take weeks to scale from 25 employees to 300, so it takes a while. But
I just have this vision of, I don't know if you saw The Sting, where they're trying to get these extras into the room to pretend as if it's a big gambling operation. It's kind of just...
No, what you do is you back a truck up to MIT, and you start putting them in the back, and you take them about 2 blocks away, and you put them to work. But the interesting part is the story of Akamai, which is a fascinating one. And yes, they did come in second to DirectHit, and it was the wonder of this, I think the fascination of all this is that what you're seeing up here and what you see out there, how many employees do you guys have? So you got 60 and 55, and how many?
About 300.
And we've got 300. So you're seeing companies that didn't exist 2-3 years ago. And through the efforts that came out of somebody's head, through ideas, pure and simple ideas, you're now employing 700 and some people, probably renting or leasing space, a few hundred thousand, 600,000 worth of space. You're creating wealth. You're adding to this economy that supposedly is going down the drain, which if the housing prices, I just moved up here, any indication, I don't have to disagree with that. But it's utterly fascinating that you can take something that was in your head and turn it into a business. And so I think it's great. And I think I would submit that we're still on the front end of it, very much on the front end. And probably much like if I lived in Detroit in 1899 versus 1999, I probably wondered what they were putting up across the street when they started building a car factory. Wondering if I was 4 years old then, I would have grown up with horses and dirt streets and suddenly see somebody building cars and building a factory across the street. I'm sure the thought process was very similar to what people think right now. So that kind of helps me believe that we're still on the front end of it. But Akamai is a wonderful story. You have Tim Berners-Lee, who is pretty much credited with inventing the World Wide Web, out in the hallways at MIT, and he walks up to Tom Leighton, who headed the algorithms group at MIT, and he said, Tom, do you think you could use algorithms to solve some of the hotspot problems and the speed problems on the Internet?
A hotspot problem is too many people run to the same site at the same time.
Right. Breaking news on CNN, everybody runs to the CNN site.
The star report is released at the...
Right. You know, crash and burn. CNN's a perfect example. The only way they kept from crashing when the star report was released was to take down all the banner ads.
because if you look at a site, if you looked at the Raging Bull site, here's a perfect example. That's a lot of text and not a lot of other things. But what Bill's company makes money off of is that banner ad. So the extent he can load up his site with more banner ads, that's potentially more revenue. So same with CNN. So when you have to, or if Bill had to strip those banner ads off his page in order to keep the site up, which he would do because he doesn't want to lose viewers, then he would be losing revenue and still have to produce and do what he's having to do. So that's the hotspot problem. And the other issue is that it's become very quickly known that speed is what does it on the internet. There are a lot of research out there that says a slow site will lose. I was talking to these guys earlier, and you walk through the Logan Airport, and there's a big advertisement for E-Trade on the wall as you're walking down one of the gangways down there. And it does not say secure. It does not say, good stock trades cheap. It says fast. So speed is what does it. So that is the problem that Akamai, which we are on the infrastructure side, was put together to solve, and that is trying to deliver content around the internet faster.
So did you have a solution at the point you raised money, or you just had a problem?
The solution is very interesting interplay between academia and business. The solution was the subject of a thesis by one of Tom Layton's grad students, PhD candidates. That solution was done as a thesis. The two of them then
had been long in progress, or the thesis was begun?
No, it goes back to 1995. So notwithstanding the fact that we're a young company, the underpinnings of the company do go back 3 or 4 years, so it's not something that just came into being overnight. And the two of them then hooked up with a Sloan Business School first-year student and put together a business plan to submit to the same MIT 50K contest, and out of that grew Akamai. And that was before they had any funding other than their first round was pure angels, and that is family members and friends who threw in the seed money to get the company going. That was in August of 98. First round of venture funding was in November of 98. Second round was in January of 99. Third round was in April of 99. June of 99, Apple Computers put $12.5 million in as private financing, but is also in connection with a strategic deal. August of 99, Cisco Systems put in $49 million, part of a strategic deal, but also in terms of private money. September, Microsoft threw in another $12 million, and then we went public October 28th and raised an additional $234 million.
And what was your IPO price?
$26.
$26, and the stock opened at?
$110.
So the IPO price, let's just parse this out, because we've heard the same story a couple times over now. The IPO price says, we've got a bunch of shares, pieces of the company, we're going to offer to the public at large. And it's going to be X number, and this X represents some percentage of the company. And when we offer it, we set a price. And I guess a disaster would be you set so high a price that you only sell a few of the shares, and immediately the price drops, and the shares on the open market when they start trading end up going lower than the IPO.
Well, what happens is we did a fully underwritten public offering. So what happens is the investment bankers, and Morgan Stanley is our lead investment bankers, are in fact buying the stock from the company and then reselling it to the public.
Gotcha. So they warehouse them. They buy them up from you wholesale.
That's right. But they also buy them from you at a fixed price and then resell them. So in essence, they're the ones who are taking the risk that if they set the IPO price too high, they will be stuck with the shares and not be able to unload them at that price or higher.
I see. But are they bound to unload the shares at a given price?
No.
Which is why, on the first day of trading, I can't get Akamai for $28 a share unless my uncle works for the investment firm.
What is happening is you have, it's very interesting, and I won't profess to be I'll turn it back over to Bill to tell you how this process works, but basically We were ready to open at 9:30, but the market was not ready for us because the market makers had not really set a price at which they were going to buy the stock, and NASDAQ is a pure bid and ask, pure auction market, essentially. So you had some companies out there willing to buy the stock on the open market at prices that were all over the place. And what has to happen is a pure open market, so all the players can see what all the other players are doing, so they're watching each other, and slowly the bid and ask price come into line to where, number one, you don't have a bid price, which is the price at which I would buy the stock, higher or lower, or higher than an ask price, which is the price where somebody else would sell the stock. So pretty soon they come into line, and the spread between the two narrows.
But again, the difference, when you say IPO is 28, there's a bunch of people that got it at 28, I guess, starting with the investment house.
Well, that's the $26 is where we went out, and that's the price at which Morgan Stanley and the rest of the syndicate bought the stock from Akamai, so that the proceeds to the company were the 9 million shares times $26 less the selling commission.
So from a corporate point of view, is it a huge loss to the company, a lost opportunity at least, that Akamai could have set the shares at $90 a share and would have had them happily snapped up? And the company would then have raised commensurately more money, three times as much.
Well, it's a corporate opportunity you could have lost, but again, you are somewhat at the mercy or at the negotiation with the investment bankers because that's who's actually going to buy it from you, and they would not have bought it from us at $90 because they never foresaw that it would open where it did, much less go where it did. So.
And the current valuation then, I guess the way you get the valuation of the company is you take the price per share, you multiply times the number of shares, and that's the value?
That's correct.
And the current valuation, according to Bill's chart, $15.9 billion. And now let's just look at some of the other figures, too. Book value is negative 41 cents. Earnings are zero. If you're sizing this up as a company, and for all you know it makes widgets, what are you learning as you look at this chart?
Well, I'm learning it's not a widget company. well, again, what you're seeing here is that the investment community says, we like what Akamai has to say. And again, I'm just sort of saying what I speculate others would say. This is not me talking. But I mean, I think basically they are saying, we like what this company has to say, and in the future they're going to be able to be a company that produces sufficient revenues and sufficient profits to warrant us paying today and putting a market cap on today of that. Is that accurate enough? How would you explain?
I would explain it by looking at the float, which is 9 million shares, and there's 91 million outstanding, and everyone wants to buy the stock, but there's no stock to buy.
Yeah.
Supply and demand.
And just by way of comparison, let's take a meat and potatoes company we all know. I mean, like a Boston company like Gillette, right? The best a man can get. They have all this shave cream, razors, blades, been in business for years. What's the market cap of Gillette? Or something else that may be comparable. I don't know if you're having to memorize the...
$37 billion.
All right, so Gillette's bigger. Any others that would be sensible to compare? A meat and potatoes company?
Cisco.
Cisco Systems? Oh, that's clearly worth a lot, right? That's another .com. $242 billion. And Microsoft is pushing a trillion, is it not? It's up there. $400 billion? $500 million. Okay. All right, so I interrupted you anyway from the story.
No, that's fine. It's not an exact process. As you heard in the private round of financing, it's not an exact process, and neither is the public markets, but I think that there's a lot there. There's a lot for lawyers to do. There was an awful lot, and still remains an awful lot for lawyers to do. And I can talk about that, or I can talk about whatever you want.
Well, actually, the one question I have, and then let's throw it open. We've spent so much time just talking amongst ourselves. But the question I have is, so far, we have an economy, 3 out of 4 of our non-random sample, that ultimately has somebody wanting to advertise forming the basis of the revenue of the business until the business transforms. So it's going to be Gillette or Revlon or something that wants to pay money. Now, I don't know if the projections are that the total amount of money spent on advertising is going to go up since there are now so many new venues in which to advertise, or if really this is saying television is going to die because the staid ads you do in the middle of, you know, Gilligan's Island, or suddenly that money is going to be spent on this. But is that what's ultimately fueling everything? I mean, where do the VCs get their money? They get their money from good deals the round before, right? From private investors. But again, what's feeding the source of this?
I would say not everything is advertising driven. You take somebody who's doing online banking, that's a service. And it is more convenient perhaps for a lot of people to do banking online than to do it by doing paper checks and sticking things in the mail. So there's a service that people are willing to pay for. We are not, ours is a service model.
Right.
Our customers are not individuals. They are websites. And a website will come to us and say, what service do you perform? And we say, we can speed up your content delivery, and we can also help you with the hotspot problem, and we have a whole host of other things we hope we can do for you. And they pay us by the megabit that we serve.
Are you relying on patents to protect your...
We rely on patent, trade secret, copyright, a little bit of everything, and we are still in the process of expanding that. That's a moving base, and we're relying on that, and we're also relying on brand equity and getting recognized in that fashion.
Gotcha. Let me open it up. It's high time if there are questions percolating around, too. Yeah, right there.
It's a question for the two HLS grads. I'm curious whether you feel like, other than perhaps intellectual satisfaction, whether you feel like your years in law school were a waste of time.
Ouch.
Not at all. I think I learned a tremendous amount about the market economy. I sort of steered towards corporate classes during my second and third year of law school. I think there's a tremendous amount of value just in terms of strategy, thinking strategically. When you study what can go wrong for a few years, it's very easy to sort of see it, you know, as you're moving forward. So I think it was a tremendously valuable degree. You know, my parents are still upset that I didn't join the bar, but I think they'll start to get over that eventually.
You have to retire.
Yeah, actually, in point of fact, no, it was not a waste of time. With regards to specific content that I may have learned in torts or whatever, yes, I'm not going to use that, but there is a distinct value to this whole 1L indoctrination, thinking like a lawyer thing that I found to be very useful. And the ability to rigorously identify a problem and very quickly dispose of it is at an absolute premium. I think everybody here can agree that speed is the currency, and speed of thought is the ultimate ideal, and that if you can do that quickly and accurately, you're going to have an advantage.
Let me also comment on that as someone who practiced law and has seen this space. I would say it's a great education because there are so many legal issues out there that the people you might be working with in this startup, should you elect to go with one instead of I look at it two ways. Number one, if you're going to go with one of these startups, there are legal issues coming out the wazoo that they will never even think about. You heard some of Bill's today about what does it mean to be running that Raging Bull site and all of the various issues he gets, and I'm sure he either has an army of lawyers working or has to deal with a host of legal issues, many of which are novel. So the fact that you came to a place that actually advocates thinking out of the box, I think, is very helpful because this is not a fill-out-a-form practice. That would be one. And then the other would be if you're going to go with a law firm and you want to go into an e-commerce or an internet practice, I mean, there are issues out there that will keep you busy until you're 60 years old. So, which would be about 5 weeks after you get there. And the one thing I would say, I heard you were talking about 130-hour weeks that they can go. Do not go into what we're into if you think you're trying to avoid that. I have never worked. I was with
through the biggest law firms in Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. In the past 3 to 4 months, I have never worked so hard in my life.
I actually have a concrete anecdote about the role that lawyers play. It's very interesting. We were about to launch a contest that involved the ability to win a prize if you picked a song that was ultimately to be on Tom Petty's tour. And this was something that was embedded in marketing and immediately went through to the engineering side and was about 97% to being active on the website, when suddenly we realized, as a result of one of the case studies we did in Lessig's class, there may be a problem with the fact that somebody in Quebec might be able to enter this particular contest, and we don't know if there are any impacts. And we quickly sent it over to Cooley, and they have a group in San Francisco that are experts in internet contests, and they came back and said, yes, in fact, Quebec is the least of your problems. Wait until we talk about Mozambique. And
so did you hang up on them and just say, I'd rather not know? Or you actually...
It got really close to that, actually. We were about to say, screw it, we're just going to put it out there and let the heavens fall. But they convinced us that they could work like bastards, and they did over the weekend, and came back with a form that we could throw up there and modify what we did and make it work. But
So the law firm says, give us a ton of hours over the weekend, and the output is a form.
Yes.
And it's a form that, it's like boilerplate. It's that you're signing up for the contest, and there's some boilerplate.
What they were able to do is they did an analysis of what countries do we need absolutely to exclude from being able to participate, what particular very quick modifications could we make to the way the contest is run to include the maximum of people with the minimum of hassle. And what
people from Mozambique need not enter the Tom Petty contest.
Cannot. Quebec was completely excluded and will be forever probably from any contest that we put up because it requires you to do the entire contest in French as well.
And you could have put half the money into translating it into French.
Exactly. Or for that matter, being able to identify that the person coming in was coming from Quebec and serve up a French page, at least efficiently. There are actually tools out there now that can do that pretty well.
I like the idea the law firm has litigation, corporate, and internet contests, so you can pick any of the three departments. Back there.
It's interesting that none of you four are based in Palo Alto, Silicon Valley, and three of you are internet companies, the other ones obviously dealing with services provided to help those internet companies work more efficiently. I'm wondering whether or not you think that that is still sort of the area to be if this is your area of interest, both from a legal perspective, because that's really where the base of legal knowledge is, and secondly, from an entrepreneurial perspective, in terms of, context and getting to the major.
I just say that there's a weird thing going on in Palo Alto that has to do with the critical mass of people there. There's so much going on, and there's been enough grenade effects of companies that have sort of exploded out and sent people to the four winds that...
When a company explodes, that means it's failed.
No, not at all. Netscape is a great example. Netscape was purchased by AOL, deluge of talent into Silicon Valley.
Everybody left Netscape.
Everybody left Netscape.
So what did AOL get?
Well, that's there's a lot of conversations about that.
Yeah.
But they did not get a lot of Netscape talent, particularly executive talent and some technical talent. So, as a consequence, unless you actually already have contacts in Silicon Valley, getting into that cycle may be a little bit difficult because there's so many people who know everybody that it's becoming much more insular than it was even 5 years ago.
I would say you don't have to go to Silicon Valley, number one, because you'll never afford a house out there. Number two, it's still a great hotbed, and it is where the predominance of innovation is still occurring. I would say that this area is just incredibly, you don't have to leave Cambridge. And if you want to really venture out, you can go out to Andover or some of the outlying areas, but this is a great hotbed for it right here. And to your point, what happens is you've got Microsoft millionaires that have started real networks and, the whole Seattle area with Amazon.com, all up and down California, Austin, Texas, all around the D.C. area, Atlanta. Those are some of the bigger hotspots I've seen. New York purports to have it, and they're coming on. And Toronto, and then you go over to Dublin, that's another hotspot, and you can start going around the globe just about anywhere you want to go.
Yeah, I would just add that quickly that it's a very fluid market out there. Apparently, it's easier to recruit people because there's so many
companies that are expelling their employees for whatever reason, or employees are leaving. But we haven't lost an employee at Direct Hit. We found it harder to recruit, but the retention is much, much higher. So
this may be unusual, right? A number of internet companies go through this binge and purge process.
Right.
I remember Warren Adams from PlanetAll says half the day he's trying to hire as many people as possible, and the other half of the day he's having to hand them pink slips.
That would be a little different, but I'm thinking of people leaving just on their own
to
go to other companies. So it's not as fluid. In terms of law firms, we had Gray, Carey, Ware, and Friedrich out of Palo Alto, and they were a good firm, but we recently switched to Testa Hurwitz, and you know, they're a great firm. So there's no shortage of good legal talent here.
Yeah, head over there.
I want to follow up on that previous question about Cambridge versus Silicon Valley. It's a legal question. That is, there's a theory put out by Ron Gilson that Massachusetts enforces not the B clause, whereas California does not, and therefore there's a lot more talent. So Netscape slows it down, everyone leaves. Same thing doesn't occur here. Do you think that's true in your experience?
I don't have any data points on that.
I don't know what I've heard, but I've talked to a lot of people, non-compete. Everyone signs them, but you can pretty much have a good lawyer who can drive a truck through any of them, regardless of what state you're in. That's not true.
The flip side, too, is if I'm starting up an internet company and I want to protect my intellectual property, I'm more likely to locate it here because I know if I do go to California that I've got a good chance that somebody's going to blow right through it and go work for my competitor next week.
Yeah.
For those people that are starting companies, I was just curious as to hear what your biggest mistake was and
biggest mistake.
Okay. try to spin it positively. I think that one of our biggest challenges, and this came from inexperience, was not scaling quick enough. It's, you can never imagine what when it goes, how quickly it goes. And we got funded with the initial $2 million, and we just didn't scale up high, fast enough. We didn't hire enough people. We didn't have enough servers. So January hit, and we thought, oh, you know, we have enough capacity for 1 million page views a day, and you know, 20 people, we were ready to go. And just we had huge issues for the first 3 or 4 months. That was a huge mistake. Hiring is another huge mistake. The first 10 people you hire, it's all about management. It's going to determine whether or not you're successful or you're a complete failure. And we made one mistake. We cut our losses early.
It's wonderful euphemism.
It's definitely growing fast enough. I don't feel that we grew fast enough either. I mean, we did a second round of $2 million. I don't know what we were thinking. We should have been raising a lot more than that.
I didn't start one up, but I've advised a lot, and I would say the two biggest things I saw were not being decisive, kind of to your point about don't spend too much time hunting around. You got to be decisive, even if it's a wrong decision. You got to make a decision, and to see people ding around and not make decisions, they just get buried. And the space and the speed that this is going in. The other is undercapitalization.
I would argue that in this space that you shouldn't learn from others' mistakes. I would learn from their successes because you're going to make so many damn mistakes that you're going to spend all day, you know, taking notes.
I want to bracket the other side and say that we ramped up so quickly that our actual mistake was not being adequately prepared for the stresses that put on the organization. In other words, we had adequate capital, and we had a goal set to ramp up in a very short amount of time. And I think that was a great idea. It worked out very well, but at the same time, it was really hard. I mean, it pretty much almost blew us apart at about the 3-month mark. It was very difficult. So if we'd been able to stand back and recognize what that was going to take, engineering something in the organization to help that out would have been a great benefit.
Great. Other questions? Yes. Glue, sweater.
I'd like to.
Blue sweater. Oh, there are two blue sweaters, aren't there? Be closer, blue sweater, to me. Sorry.
Good night. I hear a few more views about how of revenue from advertising.
I can't hear you, or they probably can't hear.
I'd like to hear a few more views on your income stream from web advertising, because we heard from you guys on Akamai, but the other three websites rely more on advertising as your revenue. So in your business model or your financial projections, how tolerant would you be to a fall off in advertising revenues?
Well, actually, I think it's really interesting and important to recognize that in the internet space, the line between advertising and e-commerce is very blurry. If you click on a banner, if you see a banner on my site, that's sort of advertising to purists. As you dig deeper, if you drill down to that into that banner ad, or if you see an interstitial ad, or if you see a web page sponsored on my site, you can go all the way through to the e-commerce transaction level, with a lot of different stages in between, and there's pockets of different kinds of ad revenue that are becoming more and more distinct and more well understood, that you can diversify your revenue streams even within a pure ad model, all the way down just basing yourself on some sort of e-commerce substructure. That said, that if for some reason corporate America decided that advertising the internet was a very bad idea, a lot of internet companies would be in a lot of trouble in the short term. I think in the long term, though, the internet economy in general, advertising will take up a relatively small portion of the total amount of dollars spent.
Yeah, if advertising dried up, we'd probably just lose more money than we're losing today.
How much money are you losing today?
We're about $500,000 a month burn rate, which isn't too bad. The revenues are going up nice, but really just to talk about what you were talking about with advertising, you have to understand that these companies, we're not getting these valuations. I'm not trying to justify the valuations at all, but we're not, these huge valuations aren't being created because people think that these web pages are going to be billboards. It really is a pure direct marketing medium where you can come to my site, I can serve a contextual advertisement and allow you to click on that, complete the transaction. I know whether or not you went to Daytech, filled out that account, whether or not you're doing trading, how long you're spending on your site. And it's a true merger of all the mediums, TV, billboards, etc. It doesn't have that. So there's a much bigger dream there that everyone's working towards.
I would just add that advertising is holding up pretty well. It's projected to grow dramatically. The CPMs are stabilizing. In some cases, they're going up. Yahoo has raised theirs. But it's definitely moving more towards a transaction model, and it can depend on what it is that you're offering. For direct hit, we offer search. You can't really charge for placement there, although GoTo does. But for our product search, we can actually charge transaction fees. If we show products to users and they complete a transaction, we've brought the lead to the merchant. We expect to get a cut of that. They expect to pay a cut just as they do for the affiliate terms.
Gotcha. Before we move to the next question, I just want you, you may have already noticed, we have a reception here afterwards, so stick around and plan to, it looks like cold, warm soda so far, but other things are coming as well. And also, there's a teaching fellow recruitment meeting for those who might want to be teaching fellow for an electronic lecture and discussion series next spring in Pound 100. And you can go straight from here to there after having a warm soda if you are interested. One other quick question, too. We've been talking about, kind of lurking behind this is this implicit question of, is this sustainable? It's present so far in our discussion about just advertising revenues generally, but also the idea of, you know, is this an overheated valuation economy due for a correction or not? I'm also just curious, what are you guys' biggest nightmares for your respective companies? I mean, here you're all not really bricks and mortar stuff. I guess Akamai doesn't have a bricks and mortar counterpart, but for those of you, maybe neither does Direct Hit, but for you guys who could have some big brand just stomp you out, is that a fear or not? Yeah.
If Universal Music didn't put all their music on the net for free, I would be very scared. They're not going to, but if they did, that would happen. We've known that from the get-go. A lot of what we're banking on is that the music companies have an extremely rigorous structure about how they do their business. They've got very narrow margins. They've got a lot of very big people telling them not to lose money, so they move slowly and conservatively. If they were actually able to get together as a group and move quickly, it would be very bad.
You lose money far more effectively than they do.
Exactly. We're extremely good at it.
I don't think there's anybody in the space who's not scared to death because it's a natural oligopoly, so that means you don't need 50 Akamais, you don't need 50 Raging Bulls when the day's over, so any of us really. So you want to be one of the ones that survives. And if you look back over, I guess I saw statistics, and Bill, you might know these right off the top of your head. Over the past 5 years, it's something like 85% of the wealth that's been created on the net has come out of 2 or 3% of the companies that are out there. So it's you know, there are a lot of companies out there trying to do what we're all trying to do, but there are only a few Netscapes and AOLs and even Netscape Signet and Amazon.coms and Microsofts, and so there are a lot of losers too.
I think the internet's still in beta. You know, only 30% of Americans are online. It's a very slow connection as the cable modems sort of permeate and more people come online. You know, the market's going to just go up double or triple. And also, I don't know if anyone's read about Jeffrey Moore. He has a book called The Guerrilla Game. I haven't read it, but I've heard about it. And his explanation for this is that people are essentially placing bets on who's going to be the gorilla at the end of the day. And so maybe there's four or five contenders, and so the market caps are inflated. One of them comes out the leader, the market share from the other four goes over, and it then does justify the valuation of whoever actually becomes the gorilla in the space. So there's a lot of gorilla contenders out there right now.
You have to understand the drivers of the valuation. A lot of these companies are going public. There's immense hype. They're going public with, one of the strategies the iBanks employs, sure, we'll have 20 or 30 million outstanding shares, but the float's only going to be 2 or 3 million. So it's just immense media hype. Everyone rushes to buy the stock. And so you look at the valuation, you're like, holy cow, it's $16 billion. But in time, once more shares are locked up, more of those shares come out of the open market, supply and demand will take care of itself. You also have to understand some of the other drivers, which is, like they said, the winners are going to win huge. If you're the number five portal right now, you better be buying someone at whatever valuation it is, because in 2 years you're not going to be around.
But when you say, by the way, the market will take care of itself as more shares flood in, you mean the price will go down?
Sure, it'll supply and demand will work out in the end.
So a bunch of the people that are buying the stuff now to get in on the internet revolution, post-IPO, they get MP3 at 105, or they get Akamai at 242 was the high? No? Lower than that. But they might be the ones holding the bag, right?
Sure. It's just immense hype. There's immense media hype. And I think in particular IPOs, there's a perception of momentum there, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so it's a game more than reality for a lot of these companies going public right now. Another interesting thing that's happened is the merger of public and private markets. What's happening in public markets today is companies that would have gone through round after round of VC funding are being rushed out the door like MP3, and they're really being incubated in the public market. It's more like options rather than equity investing to some degree. So in terms of my biggest fear, the servers not working in the middle of the night is definitely the biggest one.
RagingCustomers.com. The other blue sweater guy.
I'm just curious about three things. First of all,
if you get your hands on a good business plan, you can kind of see what's being done, and you know, even if it's a different industry model from there. In terms of finding the right VCs, you want to go out and find out the comparable companies and who's hot in the space and see who invested in them. That'll get you the right names.
Actually mirrored my legal career quite closely. When I was as a corporate attorney, I was looking at various legal documents I needed to be able to put together. I'd pull down five or six samples, take them apart, figure out what they were made up of, throw out the content, take the form and replicate it. Same thing with the business plan. Get about five or six good ones, take a look at them, digest them, see what makes them work, and then put it in yourself. It's really a structure and content thing. If you understand what you're trying to communicate, the business plan itself is really a structure to be able to demonstrate that, one, you have a good idea, and two, you know how to implement it. In terms of identifying VCs, actually, it turns out Sequoia called us, so we're not a good example of that.
Kevin.
Looking at these four different companies, it looks like there are three guys who are still grinding it out, and one guy who's sitting on the beach. And I was just curious, does that make the other three of you jealous? And one guy's already figured out to cash out, basically, with a rather short actual tenure than an exploding startup.
Well, I'm pretty young, so I'm not ready to retire. These other guys are a little bit older, you know. A lot of it depends on what he's resting on the beach with, you know. It sounds like he's still locked up, so. to me, the thrill is just beginning, frankly. I don't want to sound like it's say something stupid, but I bet a lot of them would agree with me. the money is sort of out there, and you can't really get to it. You don't really look at it, you don't think about it, and you got a lot of work to do, so you don't. The night we went public, I walked upstairs, it was a Friday, I walked out of there at 8 o'clock on Friday night, and I walked out and our chief scientist was up there lecturing about 8 different people, and they were still working at 8 o'clock on Friday night. And he had no clue where the price had settled at the end of the day. All he knew was we had a lot of work to do. And because now you have put your faith, you put yourself out there to the public, so you want to show them you know what you're doing, and you didn't start out to make a lot of money necessarily. You started out to build a dream, so you want to see that dream through.
Just to reiterate that, I mean, you don't come to work because of the stock that you hold or whatever. It's all about building a company. You want to build it as fast as possible. There's a real thrill to doing that. It's hard to explain, but that's what motivates you every day. It's not about trying to, do anything other than build a business.
I also think there's a profound cultural shift. A lot of my friends are graduating this year. They graduated last year, and they're working at some iBank, and they're just killing themselves for a company they have no stake in. And you come to a company like ours, and you know, we're shooting Nerf guns around, and they own a piece of the company. It's just, it's a neat phenomenon.
And Jordan, what do you think of next?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to kind of highlight the fact that I am, in fact, still locked up. I don't have a Ferrari or an island or anything. I actually retired because I was getting such a high throughput of really, really cool ideas coming to me that I wanted to be able to turn directly at those. By the time MP3 got to about 300 people, I realized it was too big a place for me to be because
it was a dodgy old firm.
Yeah, it was. And I want to go do it again. In fact, I want to go do it again a lot. So you get involved with some of the same guys who invested in the first place, put together some seed capital funds, start getting deals with about 5 or 6 companies, and man, it's a great thing. It's like magic. You just create something out of pure hard work and speed.
Yes,
very nice. Yeah, I was just wondering at what stage you guys actually start thinking about bringing in lawyers, whether for in-house counsel or just 1 or 2 guys on staff for purposes of pension. You know, what's their sort of intellectual background? You're bringing in corporate people, you're bringing in people doing intellectual property protection, licensing, and who are the types of people you're bringing? More established, older guys, and maybe they take over, because most of you are younger guys, you bring in younger sort of attorneys and that whole process of coming in house.
I can tell you what brought me in. The company was using Hale & Dorr to do its outside corporate legal work. It was using me to do the deal work with a lot of the big technology companies and try and bring in customers. It had an IP lawyer in Dallas. It had an immigration lawyer in Boston. They had 6 or 8 law firms doing various things, and the company was getting that critical mass and getting ready to prepare for an IPO. So they felt it was necessary to institutionalize and have somebody in-house to manage all of that. So I came in, I don't know if my age, I think my experience of being practicing in a lot of areas and having some years under me, typically the general counsel is probably going to be one of your older farts around the place. And there are 300 people at our company, and there are probably 20 people who are older than I am. But that's not necessarily the case, but I've got a pretty broad range of experience that I brought to the table, and then out kind of recruiting the individual specialties.
I did most of the patent work just because of my background, so we didn't really see a need to bring anybody in-house. We would have outsourced that otherwise. All of the venture deals we just outsourced. I think what happens is if you reach a point where you're doing so much legal work, economically it might make sense to bring somebody in-house. But in terms of reviewing contracts, we tried to outsource that initially. We got 1 or 2 of our initial contracts and sent them over to Gray Carey. And the thing is, you're not really reading from a legal perspective. You're reading the contracts from more of a business perspective. Does it have a 90-day out clause? Does it have all these things that I'm interested in that they might be interested in? And so it's tough to outsource that even to outside law firms.
I'm curious, in this field, high-tech, internet-based startups, is there a gender gap? I mean, here we have a panel, to be sure not randomly selected, but not selected with gender in mind. And I noticed that every question so far has been from one gender rather than another.
Is there a gender gap?
There's a graduate gap. First, of our first 11 employees, seven of us were dropouts, so we were all male, so.
Huh.
Perhaps. Yeah, I mean, because there's a lot of technology, and that's typically more male-dominated. I also, what the last guy said, I just wanted to throw something back at you, which is to start, you know, every single industry in every business is being affected by the internet, going direct, cutting out costs, efficiencies, etc. What about you guys? You guys in my business are a necessary evil, and there are companies out there trying to cut the lawyers out of it or make the process more efficient. AmeriCounsel is a new startup with Arthur Miller on board. Fine Law, which just has tons of templates. Don't have to call my lawyer to get an NDA. Put them there on the internet. There's Click and Settle, which is kind of like an eBay, where you come and you bypass the court
Click
system.
And Settle, I love it. It sounds like a souffle manufacturer.
That could be your future right there, is to figure out how to, you know.
It's funny, though, too, because you're seeing companies in the phase where you call on lawyers to help you make sure the equity is carved up pretty nicely, but when there's plenty of it to go around, it's a party. I assume when a company goes down the tubes, right, this is where these guys say, hey, that's when the lawyers start circling, is, you know, who had what agreement, and how do you pull it apart? Go ahead.
I just don't think that'll ever happen. I mean, there's always a good, you know, a need for a good lawyer, and cookie-cutter law firms are not going to sustain themselves. So I just think that there's plenty of work out there, good work to be done.
Actually, it turns out lawyers know venture capitalists. Lawyers know insurance guys. Lawyers know all the different people within the local community because they work with them on a continuing basis. And attorneys can be perhaps the most valuable ally a startup can have in terms of making the kind of introductions they need in the nascency of the company. I've seen a large number of scenarios where one of the first real people on the board of advisors that a startup has is a well-connected corporate attorney who can get them the introductions they need. Now, this is really at the extreme nascency of the company when we're talking about needing to get in the front door with the VCs, you need to be able to get introductions to the right people. But it does turn out that law firms sit pretty well on some of the webs of what makes the business community work, and that's a pretty valuable position. And in fact, it's an interesting thing that's happening in San Diego, I don't know if it's happening out here, is the transition of law firms into an equity investment direction, where you will get essentially free legal services in exchange for some sort of equity stake, even if it's not direct equity stake, but the notion that once you're our client, when you do make it big, you'll still be our client, that sort of thing.
Two comments. First of all, I think that there's an enormous need for lawyers. I think the shift I've seen is used to be you'd see a lot of outside counsel representing companies and deals. Now you see a lot more in-house, and they may be in a business development role, they may be in a contracting role, not a pure lawyer role. And then just to speak to the gender issue, there are three of us in-house at Akamai, and I'm the only male there. So we, I see both. And the other great thing about the internet, it's a fairly new industry, so you don't have a lot of the long-held traditions, and there are a lot of women, there are a lot of minorities, foreigners. It's just like the space. It's very wide open and very equal opportunity. So you got a lot of very senior executives in the industry who are not white males out there, which is good.
Final question. So let me help to just wrap it up for us before we move to the food, which is not coming from Sodexo, by the way. We've tried to be a little entrepreneurial about the source of the food too. This was a session not much like our usual INS session. It related less towards the conflict of values that so often pops up and that I believe is the core of what law is meant to deal about, that we hit every week, and more just about filling in as experientially as possible the story of what's built the internet most recently, what's going to make the next generation internet. I mean, I'm sure that given what you've heard and what you've talked about so far, you know, issues are popping up as they're talking, right? Privacy, right? It's all about how to know exactly who the person is so that you can better sell the eyeballs. Property, as far as you see the patents getting filed and the attempt to propertize what you have as a way of adding value to the company.
and certainly to the speech issues, in some sense as to why Bill is pretty safe when he says, yep, I don't really have to police my boards, because little does he know, CDA 230 is keeping him snug and sound at night, at least from state-based causes of action. And it was a case, right, the Prodigy case, that is what brought CDA 230 around. You read one side of history of that clause, and it is to undo the decision that had found Prodigy liable for what was going on its boards between people speculating about a company and the company whose stock had tanked. So this is the Internet of tomorrow, in some sense, and it's one that I guess you all are in a position, if not to experience, to even help build and work, whether as lawyers working at law firms or as entrepreneurs wanting to start your own businesses and get a piece of a space that I guess a lot of the doors have already closed in some of the heady days, but we might be on the verge of yet another round of times are still good, the party is still going, the champagne is still flowing as far as they're hiring. Great. So anyway, when we turn next week more to our traditional format from this kind of flyout week hiatus, we're going to look at something called the real-time black hole list, which is a great example, picking up on last week's, or 2 weeks ago, talk about Marshby, Alabama, and the public-private balance. We're going to see a wholly private effort to combat spam and try to figure out in the conflict of values, is this a good thing or a bad thing? The guy who invented this tool will be flying out from California, as well as some people that have gone to bat both for it and against it. The readings are not available yet because the distribution center closed today. I'm told they'll be available tomorrow afternoon, and they're already online. So with that, please join me in thanking our guests. I've been given to understand, actually, the reception is on them, and so you should come down and join it. And also, don't forget the TA meeting, if you're interested in that, in Pound 100.